Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. Our guest today is Ellen Sussman, the author of On a Night Like This, which was published in February 2004 in hardcover by Warner Books. It is now available in trade paperback. It was published in March of 2005. I've read the book. I enjoyed it tremendously. And first of all, Ellen, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
We were talking briefly before we, while we were introducing ourselves, and let's just put a plug in for Miriam Parker at Time Warner Books, because she's the one that introduced me to your work and has been doing some of the publicity for you, and I'd like to thank Miriam for all that she does.
And so would I. She is just terrific.
Now, Ellen, if you would, On a Night Like This is your first novel, and if you would, tell the listeners a bit about your life prior to the publication of On a Night Like This, how you got interested in writing, and did you start out with stories, and how, what was the genesis of this first novel?
Okay, great. Somehow or another, from the age of six, I knew I wanted to be a writer. And I really don't know where that came from. I did not grow up in a family of writers, or even a family of literary sorts. We didn't even have books in our house. So it just came from some dream that I had, I suppose. I have a brother who's a year older, and I have a very vivid memory of climbing up onto his bed to reach his bookshelf, and I could read the titles of the books on his bookshelf, including something like The Little Engine That Could, if you remember that children's book. So somehow I was writing stories before I was reading, and I don't know if that's, I don't think that's typical. And I would copy down the title of his books, and then I would write a story to go with the title. So that's one of my earliest memories, was writing stories and making them up all the time. I also have a sister who's 11 years older than I am, and she was studying to become a teacher and used collections of my stories when she was in college to look at kids writing. So I was pretty singularly focused all the way through high school, college, graduate school, and early career as a writer. I knew that that's what I wanted to do. I studied literature, I studied writing, and I wrote and I read. So for a bunch of years I was writing short stories. I published about a dozen of them in both literary magazines and commercial magazines. Won some prizes, got a few good pats on the back to make up for all of the rejection letters that are so discouraging. But somehow or another was cocky enough or stubborn enough to keep going. And then turned to writing novels, I think mostly because the stories kept growing and I became more interested in living with my characters for longer periods of time. And even though On a Night Like This is billed as my first novel, I think most first novelists will tell you that there's piles of first novels in their closet or drawers or somewhere, and I have a few of those that were not successful for a bunch of reasons, sort of my practice novels. And when I wrote On a Night Like This, I really felt, I had a feeling that it was coming together, that the years of writing short stories and reading and learning whatever I could about the practice of writing was kind of clicking. It was an easier experience to write this book than to write previous attempts at novels. So it did feel like, not like this came out of nowhere, but this came as a result of all those years of working at the form.
That's interesting, Jan, and most of the authors that I talk to, you're absolutely right. This is not, most times it's not the first novel, it's the first published novel. Are you glad the other novels weren't published?
Yes. In fact, my agent got an offer to publish an earlier novel that had made the rounds and been turned down, and one editor remembered it, and when she saw On a Night Like This was coming out, she contacted my agent and said, "Oh, now I want to buy the previous novel." And I'm like a lot of novelists who then quickly publish everything that's, you know, from their closet or back storage. I looked back over my previous work and thought, there's a reason why this wasn't accepted the first time around, and it's not quite good enough. Now, at some point, maybe I could go back and make write one more draft or five more drafts and get there, but I'm the kind of writer who's always interested in the next project, and I do believe that I keep getting better, and my writing definitely gets better as, along with what I have to write about, what my material is. So, no, I wouldn't go back and publish those, and nor do I think anyone made a mistake by passing those up. I think I'm on to much better stuff right now.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of a hard thing for writers to do, is to kind of bite the bullet and say, you know what, there's a reason it's in the drawer. And
yeah.
I can tell when somebody's dusted something off and it's their second novel, and it, sometimes it can be a death knell.
No, absolutely. I don't think that works. I teach writing classes to adults, and I have a lot of very accomplished and published writers in my classes. And I will see somebody who's been working on a novel and it's just not working, and it may be her fifth draft, and she's so determined, and she finally puts it aside, starts something new, and the new project is just brilliant and everything's working. And I don't think that the last project was a waste of time. I think it's how she got to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow we just have to do that. It's an odd path that we often have to take to get to our best material. But I don't think that it's easy to take shortcuts.
No, I think if you look at a painter who paints canvases, a painter doesn't sit down and expect to paint a masterpiece. They throw away hundreds of canvases before
right.
they ever come up with
right.
something.
Now, so. On the other hand, one of my students is Lolly Winston, who just published Good Grief, and it immediately hit the New York Times bestseller list, and also published by Warner. And she and I did a reading together at a bookstore here, and somebody in the audience asked me, is this your first novel? And I told them just what I just told you. Oh, no, you know, don't ever believe if a writer says that, and blah, blah, blah. And then they asked Lolly the same question, and she very sweetly said, oh, this is my first novel.
Yes, there are exceptions.
First novel. So sometimes that happens, but I don't think frequently.
No, I don't think so either. Okay, well, let's move on to On a Night Like This. And the protagonist is Blair Clemens. And as the novel opens, it's a very interesting opening scene, and we soon realize that Blair is facing some dilemmas in her life, and her daughter Amanda is brought into this, and she runs into Luke Bellingham, who is a writer, a screenwriter who's written a very successful movie, and he's back in town for a high school reunion looking for lost souls. And it's a very interesting mix that you start out with. And I've got to tell you, when I started the book, I said, how is she going to do this without becoming sentimental?
Yes.
And you did it. So if you would...
That was the trick. You're being very tactful about not saying what the big dilemma is. And I think I'll give it away. When the book was first... when the people at Warner's were first thinking about marketing, they had decided that they could not... it would be troublesome to try to sell a book about a woman who's dying, and that is the secret. So they put on in the jacket copy that it's a woman with a secret. And when my husband saw that, he said, yeah, and she keeps the secret as well as you keep secrets, Ellen, because I think it's page 5 when her secret is revealed.
Yeah.
So yeah, she is dying. And when I set out to write this, I guess a little later I can tell you where the idea came from, but I knew I was in dangerous territory to deal with a woman who's dying way too young. She has a 16-year-old daughter. She doesn't have any idea how to let go of her daughter or how her daughter will go on in life without her. And oddly enough, it's also kind of a love story. It is a love story, and she meets this guy and gives herself up to love at this moment in her life. So I knew that this was a risk that I was taking because the material is so sentimental. And my background is very much in literary fiction. And I guess what I told myself all the way through the writing of this book is that the same rules apply and in terms of writing, and that what I am writing, scene by scene by scene, is who are these characters and what's going on in their lives and what's happening in the sort of in the concrete scene-making events, rather than what are the themes that I'm writing about. In other words, I wasn't writing about It wasn't as if I'm playing the violin in the background.
No.
I'm ignoring that, and I'm just telling the story on a day-to-day basis. And if I do that faithfully, honestly, truthfully, then maybe I'll be able to deal with those themes that are just so big and scary. But I can't do it by looking at those. I have to look at the people in their lives and their characters.
Mm-hmm. And you do it very effectively. And I, as I was reading, I was thinking that one of the things that I enjoyed about On a Night Like This is that it really, I think part of the story is just kind of the nature of families in the world we live in today, which is much different than the world that I grew up in when I was born 47 years ago. It was a much different, family life was much different. Now, the world we live in today, I'm a step-parent, I'm divorced and remarried, and the concept of family is much different than it used to be.
That's right. And in fact, Blair and Amanda, her daughter, have a very intense, connected family, but it's just two of them. And it doesn't, in a lot of people's minds, that would not quite seem like a family. I had my first big surprise when I did a book club presentation of the novel when it first came out. And a couple of the women in the book club said to me, "Oh, we think Blair is a bad mother."
Oh.
And I kind of gulped and thought, oh, I guess this is what happens when you do book clubs. You hear what people really think. And then I enjoyed it because I felt like I was getting to hear their take on unconventional lives. And yes, Blair's life is very unconventional. She's also a flawed character and with great challenges in life. And a lot of people will have might have trouble with some of the choices that she makes, but that's what literature is about, is those interesting, flawed characters and not living life by the book or by the rules. So you're right, this doesn't look like conventional family or conventional relationships. Last night when I gave a reading, somebody came up to me and told me that her senior citizen church group just did my book in their book club, and the women were horrified. And this woman was so delighted she had chosen the book to horrify the women in the book. So I kind of like that. I think it's fun to give people a taste of a less conventional view of life.
Yes, I think the fact that you have, if people read your work and they take the characters that seriously, then that means that you've been successful as a writer, that they're taking a side with your characters, which has to be satisfying as a writer.
Oh, it's wonderful. In fact, one of the most satisfying experiences, as I said, I've spent my entire life writing. And, you know, I really have kept sight of the important thing is the process, sitting down to write every day. But now I feel like the process is not really complete until I sit down and get my fan email and to hear from readers, because to hear from readers just makes me understand in a completely new way what writing is all about. And it is truly communication. It is. I've taken this story and shared it with the world. And when I get those emails from people I don't know in all parts of the world to tell me how they were affected by my characters, I am so moved by that. I feel like it's a gift for me to know that I've touched them in that way. It's really something.
Sure. Now, let's talk for a moment about Luke Bellingham, who basically walks into Blair's life, and he's returning from a self-imposed exile in the woods, and he's a screenwriter, and it ends up that his big movie was Pescadero. And tell us a bit, if you would, about the character of Luke Bellingham and how he came into being, and because I really enjoyed the push pull on their relationship, and it was a very complex relationship, and one I enjoyed a lot.
Well, that actually leads me to where the idea for the book came from. Some number of years ago, as in probably 6 or 7, my husband got a phone call from an old high school friend of his, saying that he was in the Bay Area and could he come by and say hello. And I had never met this guy, and we spent the morning talking, and this This man had spent his life from high school, and Neil, my husband, had sort of prepped me for the visit, that the guy was sort of a bad boy and had gone through lots of girlfriends in high school and then continued from there to lead a life of moving from woman to woman and town to town and job to job, kind of reckless, and he was certainly good-looking enough and charming enough to pull it off. And he told us the story of getting involved in his high school reunion and meeting a girl from their high school who he hadn't seen in a long time. And the woman was now dying of AIDS. In my book, I've turned it into cancer. And she had a 4-year-old daughter. In my book, I've turned it into a 16-year-old daughter. And he fell in love with her and spent the last year of her life with her. Right up to the time that she died, and I was just amazed by the story, and I said to him, what happened to the daughter afterwards, and he said, well, I don't know, and I couldn't believe that. I just was so surprised, because I had the feeling that even if this guy had been so reckless in love for all these years, having this experience of falling in love with a dying woman was probably his moment, his chance to be changed by love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the romantic in me. And he wasn't. And that really bothered me. It just got under my skin and wouldn't let go. And I spent some time over the next year thinking about it and talking about it, and finally sat down and decided I needed to write my version of the story in which my character would be changed by that experience of falling in love. So my creation of Luke is really nothing like that guy that I met, in that he was not always down and out. This guy is, in fact, just newly down and out and has newly become a recluse. But he had, in fact, been very successful in life. But I wanted to set him up in a way that he also needs for his world to be turned upside down by meeting this woman. And I then had to make all kinds of other changes, as in who is this woman and who is the daughter and what's their situation and how do I make it meaningful to me, since how do I make it my story? And that's one of the things about making him a writer and giving it a 16-year-old daughter, since I have teenage daughters. But Luke was really my entree into the book rather than Blair. I started with a strong sense of wanting to set this man on this journey, and enjoyed that. I mean, that was the first ride, I guess. A lot of the rest of the stuff came later. For instance, the idea of Pescadero, the film that he wrote, I had written Blair as the kind of character who is very strong and independent, has not allowed a man really into her life in an intimate way. She kind of sleeps around a little bit, but the focus of her life is her daughter and kind of the privacy of their lives and her work as a chef in a restaurant. And after I'd written the first draft of the novel, I thought, I don't really think I've understood this character well enough. Why is she like that? And I started to think about what had happened in her background that made her react the way she has to men. And it was only in the second draft that I decided that she had been raped in high school, and that Luke Bellingham, who would have known about that event, would have chosen to write about it for his screenplay. So it's kind of odd in the process that this was not, that did not drive my story the first time through, but came to me later and developed as another kind of interesting way to connect the characters and to get them to sort of struggle with their demons.
Mm-hmm. Now, it sounds like the man you met in real life, it sounds like maybe some of his attributes rub off on Casey, the landlord.
Yes,
and
right.
I'd like to make a...
He was transformed into the landlord.
And I'd like to make a statement right here. Casey in the book is spelled C-A-S-E-Y.
Yes.
My name is K-A...
I've never met you before.
No, my name's spelled K-A-C-E-Y, so... And I'd like to think, if you talk to my wife, that I don't have anything in common with Casey, the landlord.
All I know is that a number of men I know have asked if they could play the role of Casey in the movie, so there must be some appeal.
Yeah, but while you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, the landlord was a pretty despicable character, and it sounds like he had a little bit in common with the guy that you met.
I actually never thought about that, but that might have been the way that I developed his character.
Well, and he is, although like he's not in the book a lot, but he is an important part of the story. One of the things that you kind of touched on when you were talking about this that I don't think gets written enough about in modern fiction is the whole concept of step-parenting or families that are formed that are not nuclear in nature. And it's probably because I'm a step-parent, is I like the formation of the relationship between Amanda and Luke, because it's not easy.
Right. Oh, good. I'm so glad you said that. When I decided that, who my three characters were and how I was going to throw them into action, I realized that the last thing Amanda, the 16-year-old girl, wants when she finds out that her mother is dying is to have a new man in her life, in her mother's life. That's such an intrusion of their private world and the intimacy between them. And she's not used to sharing her mother anyway, much less at this point in time. So, yes, it is challenging. On the other hand, Luke has something real to offer. And reluctantly, they start to connect on some levels. And I did have great fun with that. And I am I'm newly married, and my husband is a true stepfather, as in really a very true father to my daughters. And to have watched that relationship develop over the years, from the moment, when he first came into our lives, my older daughter was 11, and she sent him an email and told him, "Don't date my mother, she's a witch." And he emailed back, "My family's from Transylvania, so that sounds just fine to me." So they started with a challenging introduction, and now they are so remarkably close. And having watched that for the past 7 years has been a real glimpse into how those relationships get formed and create new families and change people, and all that stuff goes into my fiction. Not always in a very conscious way. I don't sit down and say, I want to write about what it's like for a new man to come in, because of the fact I'm watching this in my family life. I think that seeps in without my consciously thinking about it, and that's a good thing. It's much better that I'm not trying to say something. Again, that's kind of dealing with themes rather than characters. But clearly those are all of the concerns and passions and demons that are driving me to write these stories.
Yes, yes. And I we have a lot in common. I've been married for 7 years and a stepfather for 7 years. So that's probably one of the reasons I could relate as well.
Yeah. Interesting.
Let's talk for a minute about Sweet Pea, because if you were in my studio, you'd see a little beagle. Actually, she's not a little beagle. She's a pretty big beagle. Karma, my companion. And I love dogs. I've been a dog lover all my life. And I fell in love with Sweet Pea, the dog, because Sweet Pea is, to me, like all dogs are, the voice of reason, the unconditional love, which we all crave as creatures. And Sweet Pea is able to accomplish things that no human would be able to accomplish in terms of healing and mending and helping people deal with grief.
You said it perfectly. I had the feeling that these characters were not always very good at communicating what they really needed or wanted, so they needed a good dog to do that for them every once in a while, and Sleepy plays that role. As you heard, that this novel is not my life story, although you get glimpses into my life, but Sleepy was absolutely true. And was our dear dog. And the day after my publication party for On a Night Like This, Sleepy died.
Oh,
she was old, but we had not known that she was ill. timing. It was as if the book has now been published and she'll live on and she could let go. The only hard part was that I started my book tour that night and had to read passages about Sweet Pea, and, you know, I actually did warn the audience and was sobbing while I read for the first couple of times, along with almost everybody in the audience. But the funny thing that happened with my publisher is that a few months before the book was published, I had sent my editor an email and I said, I don't know if you ever do this or you would let me get away with this, but is there any way we can change the disclaimer, you know, the part on the copyright page where it says, you know, any resemblance to characters is not true.
Right.
And my disclaimer, and she put this through and it actually is in the book, my disclaimer says, and I'm looking at the page, any resemblance to actual events, locales, or persons, living or dead, except for Sweet Pea, is coincidental.
I love it.
The dog was real and does live on.
That's wonderful. Well, I'm sorry to hear that Sweet Pea passed on, but that is, well, my dog's name is Karma, so there's something beautiful about dogs, and a lot of, there's a lot of books, particularly genre mystery books, that have cats, and I was pleased to see a strong dog character. Ellen, where are you at now with your writing? You have On a Night Like This, which I mentioned is available in trade paperback now from Warner Books. What are you working on now, and what can we expect in the future from you?
Well, I am about midway through a new novel, which I am loving. I went through a very hard period with it. Where I got stuck, and usually when I get stuck, it's because I've taken a long turn, and it's just a question of how far back do I go to find where I took that wrong turn. And I just solved that problem. It meant throwing away about 150 pages. And we do have to do that once in a while, but that's the danger of writing a first draft without an outline, which is what I do. I sort of discover my novel as I go along. So I have gone back to an earlier point in the novel, taken a different turn, and now am moving forward with that one again. There will be another dog character in this one, too.
Oh, good.
Named after one of my other dogs. And this novel is now feeling very good and very strong for me, so I'm happy about that after being haunted by it for too long. I'm also trying, I've not quite done this in a while, but I'm trying to write two books at once, and we'll see how that works, but I'm working on a young adult novel. I had vowed that in my adult novels I would not let teenagers enter again. I was sort of tired of writing too many teenager stories, and so, in fact, there is no teenager in my adult novel, and I guess the voice of the teenager was so loud that I finally had to start something else to give that voice to her story. So I'm trying two projects, and we'll see how that works. I've also been writing some nonfiction, and that's new for me. I had written an article that became a Newsweek My Turn column last year, and that was my first attempt at nonfiction, and a great experience, a very interesting, different sort of experience. So now I'm writing some, I guess they're kind of creative nonfiction pieces every once in a while. I don't think that will become my main thing. It certainly will always be fiction writing, but it's fun to shake it up once in a while.
Good. Now, are you doing any teaching, or are you devoting most of your time to writing right now?
No, I'm also teaching. I teach through Berkeley Extension here in San Francisco, but I'm only doing that every, like, one-day class a year, and for the most part, I like bringing my students home with me. So I have a long email list of students who have studied with me or want to study with me. And whenever I'm offering a course, I just send out an email mailing, and I have usually about two evenings a week. I have a class here, and we sit around the dining room table and drink wine and talk about writing. I just love it. I mean, sometimes I think, how lucky am I that I get paid for doing this?
Mm-hmm.
And it feeds me in some very very real ways, and not just by getting paid for doing it. But I'm not that solitary a person. As you can see, I like to talk. And when I'm sitting in my office looking at my computer, I feel like I've got all these voices inside my head swirling around, and ideas and thoughts about the process and questions about what I'm struggling with. And if I can sit down a couple evenings a week with a bunch of intelligent, thoughtful people who are also struggling with writing their novels, and we can talk through a lot of that stuff, there's nothing that's more interesting than that. So it inspires me, it challenges me, it gets me to work through some of the aspects of the craft that's the only way that if I'm working with it and I'm not sure how to make it work, I might make my class try things out that help me, you know, break down some barriers in my own work. So I'm very lucky. It's a perfect balance for me, both personality-wise and in terms of different ways of helping me get at my material. So I like that combination of both writing and teaching.
Good. Good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, Ellen, I really enjoyed our conversation today, and I'd like to recommend to the listeners that you buy a copy of On a Night Like This by Warner Books. It's currently available in trade paperback, and I look forward to having you back on the show when your new novel is out, and I wish you nothing but the best in On a Night Like This and all of the work that you do coming up for us.
That's great. Thank you so much. This has been great to talk to you.
Thanks a lot.